So please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It is Steve L. from Tannersville, and his home group is the Way Out Big Book Study Group. Good to be here. Nice to be outside again. That was my draw to this meeting, I think, years ago. It was a big meeting outside with a bunch of people and great speakers that you could sit outside and smoke. Like I said, my home group is the Way Out Big Book Study Group. I have a sponsor. And I take commitments, and I try to stay as active as possible in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Sarah for asking me to come here and speak. I've met some of you, I've gotten to know a couple of people here, and it's a drive for me. It's about an hour and a half to get here, but I love to be here whenever I can. I love meeting new people and getting out in new meetings, new places. I was just down in Florida. It's one of the things, the blessings of being sober, is that my family will accept having me with them, and it was beautiful. It was a wonderful experience. Nothing. One of the most important things to me today is family. It wasn't always that way, and. I spend as much time with them as I possibly can, and part of me spending time with them is time I owe to them for the way I was and the things that I had done. But it was beautiful. It was beautiful and warm. warm. It's tough. You wake up and it's 80 degrees outside at 7 o'clock in the morning, sitting outside by the bay and taking quiet time, prayer and meditation, and then coming back up here, it's like, jeez, can't wait for summer. But it was nice. It was beautiful. I'm glad to be here. I don't think that's some place I could spend all year round. Summertime is kind of hot there. But one of the things I used to do. I talk about this when I first get up and speak it, because one of my biggest fears, and a lot of people, I guess, I can share this, is what other people think of me. It's been the thing that that my ego and my pride and lack of humility has been one of the things that kept me from staying sober. It's my biggest fear, and I wear contact lenses now, and I'm going to go get glasses soon, but one of the things I used to do when I get up and speak is wear glasses, and then I could take them off, and I couldn't see anybody, and I would feel a lot better about that, but they're a little fuzzy now, so it's okay, I can't, I'm good, until Wednesday when I go to the eye doctor, but I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 16 years old, and it was pretty awesome. The seed was planted that, a lot of times when I used to come up and speak, I used to talk about, a lot about the things that happened, the circumstances, the things I got myself into. The car accidents, the DUI, going to jail, being in detoxes, a lot of those things. And not everyone has experienced all of those things. And I know today that those specific circumstances aren't a thing that makes me an alcoholic. So I asked God to when I was away, I spent a lot of time in prayer and meditation, asking God to show me how I could best carry the message that He wants me to carry. And a lot of things came to me. And I felt as a kid, I had a pretty good life as a kid, actually. I mean, it didn't seem that way to me, maybe, you know, it didn't seem that way to me, but I did. I had a loving family, and who did the best that they could for me. And you know, I can't blame anything about my alcoholism on them. There were some circumstances of things that I would have liked to, you know. My parents divorced when I was about 5, and we had the stepfather, and the stepfather was me and my sister. We hated him, and you know, there were a lot of circumstances, a lot of things that happened. There was some physical stuff that happened, some abuse in that sense. But it's all okay. It's all okay these days. And you know, when I first came around, I wanted to look at a lot of the circumstances on the outside and see, you know, try to pick out the things that caused me to be the way I am. And you know, and I know today that's not what makes me an alcoholic. In fact, on this past experience on vacation with the family, I got the opportunity to talk some more with my family, and I had to make some more amends. I had to make some more amends to my sister, and my stepfather did talk about some more of the experiences that we went through, and you know, they were first time parents, and you know, if I could have taken myself and put myself in their shoes, you know, I probably would have done a lot of the same things or worse. You know, but overall it was pretty good. Now, the one thing that I think about, and I think that most people can relate to, is just not feeling like I belonged. I was seeking. I was a seeker from a young age. I didn't know what I was seeking, but I was seeking something, because I just didn't seem to fit. I didn't like people. I didn't like other kids. I didn't like doing stuff. My parents dragged me into doing all these things. They dragged me into doing sports, which I was good at, baseball, football, this kind of thing. They dragged me kicking and screaming into camp, and I grew to love some certain things. But for the most part, I didn't like to be around people. I didn't know how to socialize with people. I didn't know how to talk with them, and I enjoyed just wandering around in the woods by myself. And I spent a lot of my childhood doing, growing up in the Poconos. You know, that's all we had was woods everywhere. You know, maybe I would have been wandering the streets if I was in the city, but you know, I spent a lot of time alone, and I felt okay that way. And you know, getting into my teenage years, I started looking around for I was an attention seeker. You know, I wanted to be liked. I wanted to be loved. I felt like, you know, if I had this attention and people liked me, and then, you know, I would feel better. Things would be better. So I started seeking out the people that, you know, everybody knew. You know, I found a group of people that seemed to be the people that everybody knew and everybody liked, and they seemed a bit kind of deviant. And you know, I found my way into that. You know, I found my way into this group of people, and you know, right on the borderline. That was on the borderline of those years where I first picked up a drink, and these guys were already involved in this kind of stuff and the other extracurricular activities. You know, I dove headlong into drinking when it began, but there were a lot of other things going on there too. I mean, there were, you know, it's part of my story. There were certain things that I said I would never do. You know, You know, I'm gonna smoke some grass. I'm gonna drink. You know, I'm gonna take some mushrooms. I'm gonna do this, but I'm not gonna do that. And I'm not gonna do that. And I would sit in the library in school, and I would have all these books. You know, I'd pull out all the books in every single, you know, everything there was, you know, drugs, alcohol, this, and I would be reading. I'd be reading information about it, you know, so I had an idea of what I knew I was getting into. And, of course, I eventually ended up doing all of the things I said I would never do, and more. You know, that idea, that powerlessness was prevalent back then. When I first started drinking, I can't recall my very first drink. You know, I can recall some experiences, and with my first experience with drinking. But I can remember what it did. I can remember exactly what I was thinking when I had my first real experiences with alcohol, and that was that this is what I've been missing. You know, this is the thing that's been missing in my life. This is it. This is what life's all, and everything at that moment shifted. Everything shifted towards alcohol is what I want, and this is what I want to do with my life, and everything else is going to come after that, you know, because it took away whatever was going on inside me, you know, I was able to start talking to people, I was able to be social, I was able to tell you what I actually thought about you, you know, and, you know, I had a pretty heavy tolerance from the very beginning. I was the designated drunk driver among the group. You know, it was always handing the keys over to me because, you know, I seemed to be able to keep myself under control when everyone else was, you know, puking on their shoes and all that kind of stuff. And alcohol very quickly took over. During that period, during my teenage years in high school, and I quit everything that was extracurricular in my activities in school. Excuse me one time. Academics, you know, I did really good in academics. I mean, not patting myself on the back or anything, but I was doing very well in school, and that became not important. You know. I became, I was starting not to go to classes, skipping school, in classes a lot, and even just by myself, you know, I would steal a bottle of cooking wine or something from my job, and you know, I would leave school or not go to school, and I would go to a park, and I would sit in the car, and I would drink a whole gallon of wine or as much as I could, and I would pass out, and I would wake up there. You know, a couple hours later, and this became the routine. This became the routine to the point that the fear that I was going through kept me from graduating high school. You know, the school seemed to think that since I wasn't making enough classes and not doing enough of my academics at that time, that the story goes and. And this is how I can believe. I am so good at believing my lies. I'm so good at believing the lies. I told everybody for years and years, and I truly believed it, that school, they kicked me out. They kicked me out of my senior year because I had missed so much school and just doing the things I was doing. They kicked me out of high school in my senior year, 6 weeks before graduation. You know, and... the truth is that, and I found this later from my mom when I was making my dance, and my mom, she said, they didn't kick you out of school. And they offered you an opportunity to stay after school every day for the rest of the year and make up work and you could graduate. And you said no. And I was like, really? okay, you know. So now I'm looking back at my thinking, looking back at my past and my memories, and I'm trying to figure out what's the truth and what's not. You know, because I was good at that, and you know, it was probably, you know, I didn't want to be judged. I didn't want the shame and humiliation of that I actually quit. you know, rather than they, you know, it's just better to say they threw me out. You know, alcohol progressed. I mean, and like I said, during those years, there were other things. There were other things in there, but alcohol was my mate. Alcohol was there, and it was going to be there when I walked away from a lot of those other things. I think probably one of the things I think is important is to know your truth about these things. And you know, I would have said at one point that I'm an alcoholic and I'm an addict. But there were certain things, looking back in my experiences, that I walked away from them. And then there were certain things that I couldn't. You know, marijuana was one of those things that I just got tired of it, and I did, and I didn't want to do it anymore. with alcohol, I couldn't do that. And it got worse. I'll slip back a second. You know, I talked about my first experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous being when I was 16, and I had a girlfriend at that time. Who was doing the same things I was doing, and she ended up in recovery. She ended up in rehab, and in order to graduate school, she had to go to rehab. And of course, coming out of rehab, went into AA, and of course, I followed her in AA because I was going to do whatever she was going to do. And I stayed sober for a while, you know. At that point, you know, I still probably had a little bit of power of choice over what I was doing, at least to certain degrees, you know. I had come into AA, and I didn't do the steps, you know. I don't even know if I considered doing the steps, you know. At best, for the time I was there, I did manage to get a sponsor, you know. I picked out some old guy. It seemed like he was, you know, a good guy to talk to, and I never called him, and I went to meetings just to be there and talk about some things that were going on with me, and you know what, I was a bit happy at that time, a little bit happy during that period, because what I saw happening was, I'm going to graduate school, you know, I'm going to have some money in the bank, I'm going to go to college, I'm going to do these things, and what ended up happening was, you know, that girl left my life, and I met another one, and that other one was not an Alcoholics Anonymous and not sober, and the idea of sitting down and drinking some vodka with her trumped, you know, AA, and I went right back quick, right into what I was doing, and I've had that type of experience over and over again. You know, my family, I talked about my family a bit, and you know, my family, one thing that is a little bit, was a good thing to looking back on it was, my family moved away when I was 18 years old. My stepfather got a job somewhere. I was 18. I was not in school. I was working. And my mother kind of wanted me to come with them when they moved to St. Louis. But I said, no. You know, friends, work, partying, you know, I'm good. You know, and so... I saw my family very little over the years that I was very active in doing the things I was doing. So they weren't exposed. They weren't exposed to a lot of what was going on. They didn't know. They didn't know how bad I had gotten. They had an idea. They had an idea. You know, when I would come home for a family function or something like that, Christmas time, you know, something would be said at the dinner table about, you know, me going back to school or something, and I would wake up in the car in the driveway with a huge resentment and a hangover, and you know, so they had an idea. They knew of the things that were going on when I was in high school, but they didn't realize how the progression had taken a hold of me over the years. I picked jobs that were conducive, you know, or I just slipped into the jobs that were conducive to what I was doing. I worked at hotels, resorts, where they put you up. They put you up in a room. They let you live in a room. You know, they took this stuff out of your check, so there was no going to spend the money before, you know, you could pay the rent. And it was cheap, and everybody was drinking. Everybody, you know, at least I thought so. Everybody was drinking, partying, and all this kind of stuff. And despite going through the difficulties, I mean, I had gotten fired and rehired and kicked off of the property and back on and all this kind of stuff. I managed to survive in that. And, you know, the jobs that I had did that. They did that for me, and it was very conducive to my lifestyle. Now, and the progression took a huge hold. It took a huge hold. I knew somewhere. I tried a lot of the things that we try. You know, it talks about in the book. It talks about you know, trying various ways to control and enjoy my drinking. You know, because I was having trouble doing that. You know, when I was controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. When I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it. And, you know, I moved around different places. I stopped hanging out with certain people. I tried to dress up nice and be, you know, look respectable. And I tried all kinds of these things. I tried not drinking tequila anymore. You know, and this stuff, you know, for a little while, certain things kept me kind of okay, you know. But I could never do it for that long, you know. That day never went by when I wasn't drinking. That day never went by. If I could scrape up $6, I could get 2 6-packs. Down at the bar, you know, 2 6-packs of shittiest beer. But you know, I seem to get by that way, and I would just try to do other things too, like you know, I'm not going to drink till I'm done cleaning the house today, you know, whatever it was. I failed at it. And I remember, you know, distinctly. I remember standing out in the parking lot where I was working at this job, a restaurant I had worked at. I'd worked in that industry for years. My father owned a restaurant, so I grew up cooking, and you know, I figured this was going to be what I was going to do. So I grew up in the restaurant industry, and I was standing outside of work, and I'm looking up at the sky, and I'm thinking, and you know, I know one day I'm going to end up back in AA. I know, as soon as I hit a bottle. Anyhow, because that's all I could really remember from AA at that point was that they said, I have to hit a bottom, so let's do that. You know, and, you know, I tried really hard and I succeeded at it pretty well. I didn't realize how bad it had gotten, my drinking, until I had a hostage. You know, at this time, you know, and this girl, she didn't drink really. She wasn't alcoholic. I had no idea what she was interested in me for. But you know, I had this hostage, and there was something inside me that was screaming for change. And so the idea was, we'll just quit the job. We're going to quit our jobs and move in together somewhere. Good idea. It works. You know, quit working and move in together. And, you know, at that time I was working 6 days a week. I was working 6 days a week, and I was drinking every day, all day. You know, I was, that was my way of drink. You know, my style of drinking was taking 4 or 5 shots of vodka first thing in the morning and carrying a flask with me all day. I came to realize that my work was having an element of control in how much I was consuming, because I could only drink so much. And we went on vacation when we first quit the job. If you quit the job, you go to Ocean City, Maryland. You know, it takes some time, some well-deserved time. And I drove on the way down and didn't drink. And I started to get sick, and I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know what was happening to me. She drove the rest of the way. We got to the hotel. I went straight for the bar. I asked for a double of whatever the beer, and I picked it up, and it's, I'm shaking in my hand. It's spilling all over the place, and I'm trying to get this thing up to my lips, and I managed to get this thing down, and I wash it down with a beer, and I go, huh. The people next to me are like, are you okay? You know, I said, yeah, you know, I have real high blood pressure, you know, and they said, maybe you shouldn't drink then. I said, no, this helps, trust me, it helps. And, you know, that's one of the things we do, too, and I lied to my doctors, you know, I was fortunate enough to have health insurance at the time, and I was going to the doctor, and the doctor would say, you smell like you've been, like alcohol. Every time you come in here, you smell like alcohol. And I would say, well, sir, you know, I have one day off a week, okay, and that happens to be this day. And I go out the night before, you know, because it's the only night that I can go out and have some, he bought that. You know, so he put me on blood pressure medication, which caused a whole bunch of other problems. I had fainted one time at work. I had passed out because of the medication, which I really didn't need. I just needed to stop drinking. And you know, when I did stop drinking, I went back to my doctor. I told my doctor everything, and of course everything was normal. But you know, one of the things to do, I can't be honest. I can't be honest about these things to the people in my life, you know. Quickly, at that period, when I quit that job, it's 2005, and that's when I first came back into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because having no job, while I was working another job, I got one, but it was just a couple hours in the afternoon. Oh, Christ. In the afternoon, if I could make it to the afternoon, you know, I barely made it to work sometimes because of the way I drank. You know, I can't have a job at 4 o'clock in the afternoon because I start drinking when I wake up. You know, and I quickly progressed into that. I don't know what day it is. I don't know what time it is. Mode kind of thing where I'm waking up. On the floor and this kind of thing. So my alcoholism had gotten very physical, and there came times when I couldn't drink. You know, I wanted to drink and I couldn't drink. And I this is when I started ending up in hospitals. I started ending up in hospitals, and I had come to the decision that it was time. It was time, and put myself into a detox. And I spent 5 days that the state allowed me to be there, and came right back into AA. I hadn't been there in years, and people remembered me. People remembered me from being there when I was a teenager, and I was ready. I was hot to trot, and you know, having it. I think it went about three weeks. Making meetings every day, and you know, it was a miracle for me at the time to be sober more than 2 or 3 days. Now, I went about 3 weeks, and I said to myself, I'm just going to drink for tonight, and I'm going to go back to a meeting tomorrow. That should work out. Now, I did go back to the meetings. I did go back to the meetings, but I couldn't stop drinking again. You know, as soon as I put the alcohol in my body, I was done. I was done for. And it took a series of me getting back into detoxes. Then this is when my family got to see what was going on. My family got to see what was going on with me that, you know. I It was the only time I walked out of a detox in Illinois in November of 2005 and came home, and I made the commitment to that, you know, we needed to really do this, you know. I wish I could say, I don't wish I could say. I didn't stay sober, since that time. I'm going to talk a lot about my experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous because it's important. I had a good three and a half years sober. I did a lot of things, man. I got involved in AA. I got involved in meeting. I got involved in my home group. If I missed a meeting during the week one day, I felt guilty. I was making meetings every day, sometimes two a day, and I started working with a sponsor that somebody had picked out for me at the time, and you know, I didn't know a whole lot about what I was doing. I was willing to do whatever, and I believed whatever you told me, and. The sponsor I had picked out, he was a nice guy. He had 20 some odd years, but what I didn't know was that he'd just come back into AA after being dry for 17 years because he had put a shotgun in his mouth and decided that he wanted to take his own life and decided to come back to AA. And I started working with him on doing the steps. You know, as it was given to me at the time. You know, started working in 12 and 12. Started working in 12 and 12, and my first experience with my fourth step was one of these. I wrote out my whole life experience on paper, everything that I had done, and. It's a big notebook full with all this stuff, and we read it together. He pointed out, the seven deadly sins in here, and said, "Okay, just don't do that stuff anymore." And next, burn it. And that's what I did. And when it came to amends, I was told. When I came into doing my amends, I was told that. Told me that others is you, and where except when to do so to him or others. Others is you. So I really narrowed down my amends list. It got short, got real short there. I kind of went, whew, thank God I don't have to face all these things. And of course, the first thing I did under my own direction was go to all my ex-girlfriends first, to tell them how good I was doing today. And, I should have known, a couple of, after getting into my third year sober, I felt good. God's grace was good on me. God's grace was really good. Gave me a lot of opportunities. And life was good. All these things in life get good. I have money in the bank now. I have a car. I have a license. That was one thing that I didn't have for years. I have a license. I had some decent relations with my bosses. My family was, trusting me and all of this stuff was good until it didn't seem like it was good enough. And I went through that I started to develop this kind of I'm missing something here. The restlessness, the irritability and anxiety started to creep back in, and I don't know what it is missing, but the shine on everything is wearing off, it's like that new car that you might think the new car, and the sobriety was like the new car, but then after a year or two, it's like, I don't want that anymore. I'm not backing it. I'm not cleaning it. the shine was wearing off, and I realized that something was wrong. But I had grown complacent. And I felt that, you know, I wanted to stay sober no matter what. The rest of my, you know, I wanted to stay sober. I was dead set. And but my willingness had really, you know, pretty much disappeared. And I told my sponsor at the time that I was going to find somebody else to help me. I wanted to take some new direction. And I should have known when I got my first sponsee. Now, my first sponsee was given to me by a man. And I didn't know what to do with this guy. You know, I'm on the internet, like, looking up information on there's got to be some worksheets or something here. And, you know, I really didn't know that I had what I was missing. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, my alcoholism got to me before I could figure out what was going on. And it snuck in, you know, you know, I talked a little bit about this before. My father had a heart transplant, and you know, thankfully I was able to be there. I was able to be there while he was going through this process. And when he came home from the hospital, he had this medication, you know, and I took a double take at that, and you know, I don't know what this stuff is, but I took some of it out, you know, this oxycodone and stuff, and I said this would probably work good for a headache or something, you know, and I prayed about it. I took that stuff out, and I felt the guilt, and I felt something wrong. I prayed about it, and I put it back, and of course, I never told anyone about this in AA. I never told any of my friends. I never told my sponsor. I just, you know, that was one of those things that happened that nobody needs to know about. And, you know, that's one of the big parts. That's one of the big things that I suffer from. One of the things that had kept me from being able to stay sober was my inability to get humble. The humility. It talks about it in the book. It's amazing how certain things will pop out when you're reading the book and when you're going through stuff. And you know, there are things that I was not willing to talk about. You know, there were things that I was holding back. And you know, I went back out at that in 2008 on that same thing. My grandmother had this same kind of. I was with my grandmother at the time because I was doing so well in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time that I was dating a girl who could just not stay sober, and you know, I just didn't see what was going on with me in my life, and I was living with my grandmother because I couldn't live with my girlfriend anymore because she was drinking, and you know, she had that same stuff, and the same thought came to me was just, I'll take some of this and it'll, you know, it'll help me with my back, and if something feels funny, then I just won't take any more of it. And sure enough, When I took that, I felt that thing that I hadn't felt in a long time. And you know, we talk about that ease and comfort from taking that first drink. That was that feeling that I got. You know, this is what's missing. And of course, I wasn't going to tell anyone that this happened either. I was gonna not do this stuff anymore and keep in AA and just get my stuff straightened out and keep on the road to wellness here. And it was only a matter of time till I found myself at the liquor store, you know, with a bottle, showing up at my girlfriend's house saying, you know, let's go to Music Fest. You know? I got a lot of liquor in the trunk, it's all good, let's go. And during that period, I went through. The thing that always happened to me when I pick up a drink was a matter of days, I'm back in detox again. And I never stopped going to meetings, and I just couldn't for the life of me figure out why I could not stop drinking. I mean, why did this happen? Why? You know, and, you know, a lot of guys I was talking to were saying to me, you know, maybe you're not ready yet, and maybe you don't want it enough, you know, this kind of thing. And I couldn't figure out what was happening. And I ran into a fella at a meeting, and he sounded different than most of the people I was used to talking to. And he asked me what my idea of the first step was, you know. And I told him, I said, you know, when I drink, this happens, so I can't drink. You know, and he said, that's what I thought, you know. And you know, the problem is that, you know, you're going to drink no matter what. And unless you find a higher power, God, that's going to keep you from drinking. I mean, that's basically essentially it. You know, and I didn't really, you know, I really got to see the nature of what my powerlessness really meant during that period, because I had the most desperate desire to stop drinking, and I could not do it. And you know, I had this period of time, this 3 years of being sober, and I couldn't figure out why I'm still drinking, why I'm picking up after 90 days, after 60 days. And I started working with this guy. And through the middle of, I'm working on the fourth step with this guy, and my thoughts are that I've done this kind of stuff before, maybe not this way, but I've done this kind of stuff before. You know, maybe it's going to do something, maybe it's not. But he came to me and he says, Stephen, your window keeps getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Every time you pick up a drink, you have 60 days, you have 30 days, you have 2 weeks. Why don't you finish doing this work and finish writing your fourth step so, you know, we can get on with this, you know? And of course, you know, New Year's Day, I don't remember what year it was, 2008, 2009. I woke up, got out of the hospital, came out of the hospital again, and I said, let's finish this. I'm ready, you know. And when I went through this fifth step with this guy, I got to see a lot of things. I got to see all the things that I didn't get to see before. You know, this is the first time I did a four-column inventory. This is the first time I was exposed to the ideas of the things that were behind, going on behind the fear and the selfishness and the self-centeredness that I had no idea. And after we finished the fifth step, something happened. Something changed to me. The way I looked at everything, the way I looked at the world. It was like the blinders had been taken off. And I was on this high, sober, that I'd never felt in my entire life. And I'm not gonna lie, I had a good time drinking. You know, I heard people say that, you know, they wouldn't trade their worst day sober for their best day drinking, but man, I had some good times. When alcohol was working in my life, I had great times, man. But unfortunately, it stopped working. And you know, I went on this bender. I start to really actually work the steps, and I actually started to feel this connection with God. And I started making a lot of amends. I started making a lot of amends, doing prayer and meditation, things that I wasn't doing before. And somewhere along the line, I stopped. You know, I stopped making amends. I stopped, and I stopped making as many meetings. And I got to this thing, and I was reading through some of the book, and a lot of things that started to pop out, and which have kept me from staying sober. And the things that popped out on me was that I subjected myself to solitary self-appraisal. I stopped sharing what was going on with me, with my sponsor, with my network of people. I would do my prayer and meditation, and I would come out with these ideas. moving in with this girl and leaving here is a good idea. This is what God wants. I need to leave these people. I'm a burden on them, and I need to take more responsibility in my life. And, this is what I'm doing, and I'm not sharing any of this with anybody. I'm running this thing, and I set myself up out to drink a couple of more times doing this. And the other thing is what I just talked about a little bit when I got up here was, my biggest fear is what people think of me. Everything's got to be good, everything's got to be great, everything's got to be just fine. And there were certain things that, in here it talks about, I could probably actually read it, because it really stuck out at me. It says, time after time, newcomers have tried to keep themselves certain facts about their lives, trying to avoid this humbling experience they have turned to easier methods. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. They took inventory all right, but they hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They had only thought they'd lost their egoism and fear, they only thought they'd humbled themselves. And this was my experience, when I started working with my sponsor again and doing inventory and writing and putting everything out going from the beginning, I realized that I had left out some things. I left out some things that I thought didn't belong there. I was willing to make amends, but I neglected to put any of my financial burdens on here because I didn't think they belonged on my amends list. I really thought that this financial stuff was going to be between me and God, and where we're going to figure this out. I was going to, pray about this, and one of the things I would do is I would pray for God to take away the fear and direct my attention to what you have me be, God. Take away this fear and help me face my creditors and help me do this. And the fear would never go away. The fear would never go away. Until I shared it with somebody. I took this stuff and I said, here's something that's going on that I hadn't been able to really talk about it because I didn't really think that, And, everything changed. What I think I know, I love that suicide prayer. We just said suicide prayer here. Is one of the big things that I've kept in my prayer, meditation, my daily life, set aside the things that I think I know, because my experience has been that those things are the things that bring alcoholism back up in me. I think I know what I need to do. I know what I'm supposed to be doing. I don't need to share everything, but my life's got to be an open book, really. I need to experience the humility and the humbleness of saying, I'm going through this. This is what I'm thinking. I recently had to deal with some tax stuff. Some of the things in my financial demands and burdens happen to do with the IRS, and it was one of these things, man, where I do this, I'm so filled with fear, I'm so afraid to face this thing, take my stuff, garnish my wages, I don't know what they're going to do, and I roll with that for weeks, so I decide that I'm not going to I'm not going to do my own taxes. I'm going to have somebody help me, you know. And I got on the phone with the IRS, and the lady was so nice. She was so nice. And I said, well, you know, what can we do here? How can we work this out? Can we do this? Oh, yes, we can do this, and we can do it, and it's all, and everything's going to be great. Thank you for calling. Have a nice day. And I was like, wow, man. You know, I was dying. I was dying inside because of this stuff. And you know, today it's very important to me. I believe my life has to be an open book, and I believe I have to share. And I've learned that trusting my thinking is the last thing I need to be doing. I do a lot of prayer and meditation, and I sit every morning, and I sit with how I can be as best service to God and my fellow man. What can I do today to be helpful and be of service to others? You know, and I make it a priority that's in there. How can I be a better son to my mother and my father? How can I be a better brother? How can I be a better employer, employee? All of these things, you know, I sit with and get a review, and what I come up with, you know, out of this experience of prayer and meditation, I make sure I share. I make sure I talk about it with other people. I live with these two people. They're like Bigfoot thumping, you know, Nazi crazy, you know, and there's no reason why I shouldn't have anybody to talk to about what's going on in my life. And you know, my experience to this point has been just something new. It's new, and it's beautiful. I'm exceptionally happy to be here. And you know, it's hard for me. It was really, really difficult for me to want to come up and share and talk in front of people in AA and in front of the people at my meetings because of my experience with not being able to stay sober. But thankfully, you know, at this point I have about a year and a half, you know, thank God, you know, and thank God only, you know, for the grace of God I'm able to be sober today and be here, you know. I don't have, one of the other things that I think about is, you know, I don't, the power of choice, I don't have that. I did this thing, and we talk about it, the book talks about being able to control and enjoy your drinking, and I flipped this thing around it, and the thought came to me and said, where are you in your sobriety trying to control and enjoy your staying sober? You know, because I can't do that either. You know, and I realized that that I'm very grateful today. I'm grateful today to be sober. I'm grateful to be here. I'm glad that you asked me to come up here and speak. There's a lot of great people here in this group. I've met some great people, and that's all I got, you guys.